little bit further, it isn't only me who felt that way about Mac. Everyone that worked for him, the design staff, felt that way. And when McKeegan left, he left in anger because he thought he would inherit the job that Irv Rubicki got. And Mac wasn't selected for the job. Irv Rubicki was.
So the reason why?
Why Irv got it instead of Mac?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I feel that they felt Mac was Irv was better qualified than McKeegan, and he was certainly better liked. And in this day and age, personality has a lot to do with, and the way you run people has an awful lot to do with your success in business. And Irv was head and shoulders above Mac in this regard, and Mac was running it like the old curmudgeon would. And this isn't appreciated by business or by people today. And so Mac lost out, and he retired, and he left, and as far as I know, no one's heard of him since, and feel very happy about it.
He's not in the design business.
As far as I know, he isn't, no.
But this time, you have another diversion that's cropped up.
Well, yes, you see, while I was still with General Motors, probably about 1970, I became involved in a venture in Florida with a financier in Detroit and a builder in Florida, Dick Dawson and Bill Lutz. I was told at that time that mobile homes were the big thing in Florida. There was a lot of money to be made in them.
What year was that?
And it was 1970. Mm-hmm. So, but we didn't know that in 1973 there would be a big depression. It hit Florida particularly hard, and particularly the people who live in mobile homes, which are not necessarily the high-income group. So we went to Florida, looked around, found what we considered to be a very good piece of land, bought the land, and then proceeded to get mortgages and develop the mobile home park. I helped to lay the whole thing out. I designed we had two recreational buildings down there, beautiful clubhouses. And it was in Tampa, Florida, just on the outskirts of Tampa, Florida. And we call it Fountain View Estates. And it was to be the largest mobile home park on the west coast of Florida. We
have Fountain View or Fountain View?
Fountain View, we call it ours, yeah.
Did you have a fountain in view?
We did have a fountain. I said, hell, we've got to have a fountain. You know, Bill wanted to call it Fountain View. We did have a fountain as you drove in. We had a regular boulevard in there. We had big palms. You know, if you're going to have a place to look like a Fountain View, you better have palms. So we had palms brought in. It's a beautiful place. Cost a great deal of money. And it got all kinds of plaudits and write-ups and architectural books for the way we landscaped and developed the entry and so on, and the clubhouses. But then the depression came along. It wasn't really, you know, when you're doing anything, you're in another business or any type of business, you should spend a great deal of time right on the site. I was with General Motors, you know, 1,500 miles away, and the man who was developing it was there part of the time. Dick Dawson, the financier in Detroit, was never there, and consequently we had very few meetings, and the man that was put in charge as our resident manager turned out to be a sort of a fraud, and the thing went right downhill. And the depression came along, and as a result of a lot of expenses and so on, why we were going to lose it, plus a great deal of money. We finally found someone to take over $200,000 of our debts, and in my particular case, I lost $138,000, which wasn't recoverable. This plus my situation at General Motors, which I was not happy with, and I was probably striving all the harder at General Motors to make my worth felt, culminated in a heart attack. And it was a very, very serious heart attack. And I was hospitalized for quite a long time. And on the advice of my physician, he suggested I retire. And that was in 1981 I retired. But I'd been out for quite a long time on a recuperating leave. I'd been out for about a year on that. And then my doctor got with the General Motors doctor, and they put me through all sorts of tests, and the chief physician for General Motors decided that it'd be better if they didn't want to be responsible for my staying on at General Motors. So then I retired.
Did you feel this was, you obviously survived very nicely.
I felt very happy to retire, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I felt happy to retire, because I wouldn't have if I hadn't had a heart attack. But when you have a heart attack, it frightens you. You never know when you're going to have a recurrence. And it's a frightening thing, and you're not really sure what caused it to begin with, and you don't want to put yourself in any position that might cause a reoccurrence. So I was really happy to retire. You missed the... That's right. You missed the... I missed the corporation. I missed going to work every day. I had wonderful years. I had 35 good years at General Motors. Really great. It was a good career. I mean, when you consider that you're getting paid for something that you like to do, you're going first class all the way. I like future things, and you know precisely what's going to be happening in the automobile industry, design-wise, several years hence. And that's very gratifying. And then to have a part in it is more than gratifying.
You
so
see
I
your
must
creations,
say, on the road. On the road. You know, I can be driving along in Arizona or California, and geez, I see an old Pontiac coming along, and God, I remember the day that the people came in and approved that design. I remember when we were up at the board designing that particular aspect of the thing. And it may be a dog or it may be a good-looking car, but you still remember all the background of it, and it's very interesting. And there's a lot of nostalgia with it, and I've had a lot of the people, I've worked with some of the best guys in the business. God, fellow at the Center of Creative Studies right now. Homer Legassi used to be my assistant for quite a long time over there. Homer and I got along real good over there. And I've known so many good people in the car business, both in this country and overseas. I've been to a lot of interesting places. I've been to a lot of other interesting companies, and I've done a lot of good things. And I've driven the best cars in the world. And seen some of the nicest scenery, and that's not all bad. It's been a very rewarding career. I like it. Now, I've always liked to paint and draw. As I said, I started out that way as a child. So now I've been doing a lot of painting, and I'm developing a series of historical events that happened in the United States, and I now call this Gillen's Americana. And I'm putting mostly, I usually always manage to get old automobiles into the picture, old trains, usually some transportation vehicle. I like to do people. I like fashions. I'm interested in architecture, and so I try to combine all of these into these paintings that I'm doing right now. And I don't know whether I will have them prints made of these, copies made, or whether I will get some print company to make. I'd rather have a print company handle it, because they have the distribution facilities, and I could end up with 1,000 prints and then have a hard time getting rid of them, because you can't spend all your time traveling the United States to get art dealers to handle this stuff for you. But they have the outlets, so that's the direction I feel I'll go right now. It is working out very well. I've done a lot of commission work, doing people's antique and classic cars, as well as people's yachts. I know I belong to the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club. I know a lot of people with boats. I do all sorts of paintings of boats. In fact, I just finished two in a painting with the Grosse Pointe Yacht Club in the back for Roger Rinke, the Cadillac dealer out here. And Roger's really happy with that. And I have paintings all over the United States. And that makes you feel good. And just last year, I had one of my paintings selected for the opening of the Golden Age of Flight Museum in the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. They had a black tie party down there. I met a lot of the aviation greats and a lot of the people in the government and so on that were down there. It was very, very nice. Met old Jimmy Doolittle. It used to fly in World War II.
Still going strong at
90. Yeah, real old guy now. Yeah. Barry Goldwater, he's an old guy. Met him down there. A lot of people. And so these are sort of the little things that you do when you're an old retiree. But I enjoy what I'm doing. I love to paint, and I'll paint just as long as I can hold a brush. I think this is great.
You've had no recurrence of your heart problem?
No, I haven't. I feel good.
Obviously, the stress was getting to you.
I think it was, and I exercise all the time now, frequently. I'm on a regular diet, take care of myself, and generally have a very, very good life. If you've had a gratifying life, then you retire, you don't mind it, because you've got something to look back on that you did. But I'm still looking forward to doing a lot of work in painting.
You're not completely fulfilled yet in your artistic career.
Oh, no, I want to keep painting forever. I mean, what the hell? I figure if Winston Churchill could find time to do it, and Dwight Eisenhower, what the hell? Old Paul Gillen could find a little time to swing the brush. And here's the good thing about it. Long after those goddamn old Pontiacs all junked on, in rust, in, out here in the rust heap somewhere. Why, my paintings will still be around. Because usually people don't throw away an oil painting. Even if they don't like it, they pass it down to their kids, or it goes to some secondhand place. But sometime, many, many years from now, those damn paintings with my name are still going to be around. That makes me feel pretty good. Yeah.
Even though you you said that your reputation in design would fade with the disappearance of the automobiles you worked on, still in all, they are being restored. And
oh, yes.
I believe Pontiacs are still very, very much considered as a collectible and restorable.
Oh, yes, they are. In fact, I've been in contact with some of the old Pontiac, old car clubs. The fellas write to me and want to know this or that about old Pontiacs, you know. And they collect a lot of those old junkers.
So still be around.
Oh, sure.
But your handiwork will still be available.
Oh, yeah, that part will.
And in, along that line, I'd like to ask you as sort of a semi-final note. What were you proudest of in terms of automotive design? Can you point to any particular models or any particular innovations that you pioneered that you're proudest of?
Golly, that's hard to say, Dave. I you know, you work on so damn many things, you, over the years, you just forget what you're really proud of. I can't really say I'm particularly proud of any of the old line of Pontiacs. One that I was kind of proud of, I thought was good, and I had a lot to do with that, was 1950 Catalina, because we coordinated the interior and exterior color. We had with that car was one of the first to have interior and exterior coordinated color. Even the steering column. You see, ordinarily they do steering column in just whatever the chassis or the rest of it comes through. And this this car had was done. We just had it in two colors. They were reversible colors: San Pedro cream and Sierra rust, rust and ivory. And we had all the other interior trim on the car. The steering wheel was cast in a rust color. The steering column was painted. The instrument board was done that way. The instrument, all the carpeting in the car, the headlining in it. We had chrome roof bows in the car. Everything was special on the automobile, and it was one of the first cars to come out that was a hallmark in this regard. Then Cadillac picked it up, and all the rest, and they were all doing it. But at that time, they didn't have it. They couldn't afford to have one automobile that was completely coordinated throughout. And that was a Catalina, and then I named that one too. I named a lot of different automobiles over the years.
Remember some of the names?
Well, I don't know. As I said before, the El Camino was run, that I mentioned to you, and the Eldorado, as I said, I got that off a menu, and Ed Glowacki and I were having breakfast one morning out there. One of the specials was called the Eldorado, one of the breakfast specials when we were at the St. Francis. And Ed says, what the hell is Eldorado? I mean, I said, well, yeah, that's what they used to call, that's the old Spanish name meaning great find, that they, when they found the silver over in Nevada back in the 1800s. And then he was looking for a name for that other car, and that's when we got the El Camino Real.
You mentioned the Catalina, too.
And the Catalina, yeah, that was mine. Then we had one, what's the capital of that city on Catalina Island?
Avalon.
Avalon, yeah.
Oh, did you pick that up?
Yeah, we picked Avalon, and one of them didn't last very long.
Didn't last long.
We had that on one of the cars. Then I had one on there that I was going to put on the car, the Polaris. Mitchell said, God damn, it sounds like a shaving cream. So he wouldn't take it. But anyway, I put that on the list. And I know Dodge had the name Polaris on theirs. Okay. I put the name, I had a lot of names down there, which, because when they did a car, the guys at the design staff were looking for a name. And you can't always think of a name. So I had a whole lot of names, so I put these names all together, compiled them in a book, and went to our design staff library up there. And every time the guys were looking, they'd kind of go down through the list, you know,
right.
And some of the advertising groups would look and they'd go down there. Like the Celebrity that's now just on the old, on the Chevrolet since I've retired, really. Celebrity is my name, it was on the book way back. And I did all kinds of names. I just made up a whole lot of names. And like Safari and the wagon that the Pontiac put out, yeah. Like that. So
the Pontiac was a good workmanlike car.
It was a good workhorse type of car. Yeah, it was. And
it was aimed at a specific market.
Yeah, it became more of a glamour car when we came out with the 59.
Right.
But Knudsen, you know, and Pete Estes put in the necessary horsepower that you had to make that thing roll. And that made a made a good automobile.
Did you know Larry Shinoda at that time?
Yeah, I know Larry Shinoda.
Can you tell us a bit about him, his background?
Sure, I know Larry Shinoda very well. Larry Shinoda worked for me for a while there. Larry is a...
S-C-H-I-N-O-D-A.
Larry was from California, went to Art Center out there, and Larry always felt badly about the fact that part of his family during the war had been interned, as they did so many of the Japanese Americans in California. Mistakenly, they did that. And Larry's always had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about a lot of different things, but he's a very nice guy and a very talented guy. Mitchell recognized his talent and put him in the studio working on Corvettes, and Larry did an awful lot of Corvettes. In fact, most of the Corvettes that were done, Larry Shinoda was responsible for a lot of them. Now, he was working under Bill Mitchell's direction, and Bill would come out and tell everybody, I'm the only guy that knows how to do a Corvette. Well, a lot of that was Larry Shinoda's stuff. When Larry does make a sketch or a drawing, he goes all the way through the drawing. He has to just try to make a pretty picture. He goes through the drawing, putting contour lines through so you have a good idea of reading what the surfaces are, and they're not just camouflaged by highlight and shadow. He worked, another guy that worked over there was Tony Lapine. Tony Lapine, pardon? Lapine, L-A-P-I-N-E. And Tony Lapine had been a young guy. He had been under Hitler's youth movement over there. He was just a kid, and he got a brown shirt or black shirt or whatever the hell they gave him. And he was working over there. Then he came to this country. He always kind of had a chip on his shoulder, always kind of pissed off about something. But a nice guy and a good guy. An engineer, more of an engineer than a designer, but a designer, too. He had designed Flair. So he and Larry worked together on design in Mitchell's Corvette Studios down there. And both good guys, and I see Tony today. Tony says, Paul, I've got you to thank for the fact that you got me on the overseas thing. I got him his job over at Opel from Opel. He got his job because I recommended him, because I'd recommend people to get those jobs. I recommended him, and from there he got over to Porsche, and he's the chief designer for Porsche now. Oh, runs the design department at Porsche, Tony Lapine, yeah. Oh, sure, and Tony's doing good. Tony always says, Paul, God, I got to thank you for getting me over there in the first place, because, Christ, these other guys wouldn't even listen to me. And both Tony Lapine and Larry Shinoda didn't get along with Chuck Jordan at all. He'd stamp all over him, yeah. And they just didn't hit it off at all.
But somehow or other, Shinoda got latched on to Bunky Doodson.
Right. Shinoda was working in Pontiac, and Larry Shinoda was, and Doodson came down, and Knudsen liked a lot of his sketches, and Knudsen was on this hot car thing at the time, and Larry Shinoda was working in his off time around the Indy 500 time each year in the pits for some racing crew down there, and Knudsen heard about that, and he just thinks, God, this guy knows racing cars, see? So he got him in to talk to some of his race-oriented engineers up there, and it got Larry in tight. And so when Knudsen left the corporation, he decided to open up his own design group out here for recreational vehicles. And he took Larry out with him to head that program and do the work along with one of the engineers from Chevrolet. And so Larry got that job, and then some outfit bought him out. And when he bought the whole thing out, I know it was Ford or somebody bought him out in order to get Knudsen to go to Ford. And Ford went out there. Yeah, so they took the whole thing out, and Shinoda went over there with Knudsen. Mm-hmm. And then he stayed on for quite a long time. I don't know whether he's still... No. And then he left after that, and Larry started his own design firm. But he got so much money out of this rec... It was called a Rectrans. And he got so much money out of the Rectrans outfit that he was invested in it, and I guess he's living happily ever after.
So.
Yeah.
Here's a footnote. What happened to Knudsen at Pontiac? What was the reason why?
Well, no, not really, but Knudsen was up, you know, for the top job, and he was vying for the president.
He'd done well at Pontiac.
Yeah, but then he was put in his group vice president in charge of all the car groups over there. Well, at the same time, they put up Ed Cole in a comparable job over there.
He had the engineering
background. Really good. He did a lot of stuff during the war in the tank plants and so on. Then he was chief engineer, ran the Cadillac show over there. He did a lot of stuff for the corporation and all the group engineering stuff, so they put him in over Knudsen as the president of General Motors.
Yeah.
And Ed Cole's was a hell of a good guy, real, real good guy. Knudsen was too, but I guess Cole just got the nod. And then Knudsen was ticked off about the thing, and then he went over to Ford's.
He
But Knudsen is not the kind of a guy who can work with people well. He has to run the whole show himself. He had a lot of money in his background. He was into General Motors, and he was a big man there, you know. And he'd come in late in the day if he was going to a, so he wouldn't have to go home and change. If it was late in the day, he'd go to a, come in his black tie, you know. He's going to a dinner that night, and he walked through the studio just kind of showing off a little bit, you know. He's going to a party that night and so on. And he's kind of a hard guy to get along with, and you know, I think Ed Cole is a lot more easygoing, easier to get along with, and got along better with all the top people in the corporation, and they just selected him for the job. And I think rightfully so, they did a good job. Although Knudsen's a good man, a nice guy, and so on, but there's usually a reason on those things. So that's the way it worked out. Generally, as I can sum the thing up, but Dave, I can just say that I want to thank you for inviting me out here to just share with you some of the highlights of what I've been able to do in my career and some of the experiences I've had. And there's a lot of other ones, you know, but it's, a lot of things just don't come to mind.
I wonder if we could ask you one last question. Develop this as you like to wish. Over the years, as your artistic sense developed, have you ever come up with a sort of a personal design philosophy as it reflected in the projects you worked on at General Motors?
No, I haven't. And the reason, I thought of this many times, and it's like any project anybody gives you, there's several ways of, there are several answers. There's never just any one right answer to anything. And so if you're a designer, you have to leave yourself wide open, and while you have a philosophy, you find yourself influenced by so many factors that you don't always find, you can't always justify your philosophy. Because particularly having worked in a design business, a commercial design business, you're not just doing something that's going to be enduring throughout history as if you were doing a beautiful sculpture or doing a beautiful painting. That's going to be here like forever. But you don't have this design philosophy when you're doing an automobile, because it's not going to be here forever. It's transitory. It's true. It's a good word for it. It is transitory. And you find yourself influenced by market research, by the people that you work for, by cost, by what they can do. So you're never designing an automobile just to suit yourself 100%. And then even if you did, you'd find within yourself different reasons that would destroy some of your pet philosophy. It's a difficult thing to say philosophy. Design philosophy, all you can say, I could say, is that I'd have to design it the way I feel is best, the way I've been influenced as a person from the time I was born, based on taste, background, and there's different things that last forever, things that are classics, and they just last forever. And if you're in, you know, you're imbued with this sort of thinking, it's the type of philosophy that you adhere to, and automatically come into your designs. They flow into your designs. Oftentimes you don't know why they're there, but they flow into your designs. Some people are influenced by hard ridges, hard lines, creases, and this sort of thing. Others are just a blob, like a baked potato, and this sort of thing. I always just, you know, just try to make the car look as good as I can. But there again, you're trying to appeal to a certain market. If you're doing an automobile that's going to appeal to a group for a World's Fair, you've got to meet up. It's got to be, people are coming to the show. Yeah. Damn it, they want to be entertained, and you better entertain them. So you're going to do a lot of fancy stuff there that you know sure as hell isn't going to live too long. But by God, it's going to give those people a feeling that their ticket was worth the price of admission. And this is the way it is. So it's hard. People come out and say, this is my design philosophy. I believe that this is, and they expound on the thing. Artists do that. They go into a guy and they explain why they did this. You don't really give a damn why they did it. You either like it or you don't like it. If it's no good, no matter what his philosophy is, the thing's a dog. And so that's kind of the way I feel about it, I guess. I try to do the best I can, and I hope it appeals to people.
With taste and flair. I suspect, though, that you may have had your best times when you were allowed in the advanced studios, when you were allowed to do concept cars.
Oh, yes.
Which embodied the best thinking that you had at time.
That's right, and I enjoyed that very, very much. The thing that was frustrating there was that I thought they were good, and Bill Mitchell comes in, and he doesn't think they're in, or Harley Earl, what the hell did you do? No, we don't want that. Do this, do that. And they just completely change the concept on things. They make it longer. They make the lines droop too fast. They make it funny looking, or they add this or that to it. Well, then you have to alter some other thing to be in accordance with what they've done, and they just destroyed the concept. This happens all the time. The man, there's no doubt, the man that's running it is the one responsible and does a good job. As I understand, I haven't been back to design staff since I left. I've never gone back there. Oh, they invite you back. They call up. Dave Holes the other day, Paul, let's have lunch. You got to come out here. I said, no, Dave. I'll eat any other place, but I won't go into design staff. I've been there for the last time. Okay, I'll meet you over at Schmidt House or somewhere. So I meet Dave. I pick him up in front of the place and drive him over there, and we do this. But, and other guys, too. I'm supposed to go out with some of the guys next week, but I don't want to go back there anymore. I had a good life. I don't want to return to it again. When I was at design staff, I saw too many old retirees come back, and geez, they come back and they don't mean it, but they've let themselves down. They wear a funny thing with a belt in the back, a funny little coat, pants that are kind of baggy. They're good yet. They don't want to throw them out. Their shoes are, there's a lot of mileage in them yet. And they're retirees. I mean, they get them, let themselves get sloppy when they get out. And maybe when I go back, they'd see that in me. I try not to be that way, but they might see that in me. I don't want anyone to feel sorry for me going back or even to think that's the way it used to be, because I left on a high note. I've got a success at General Motors. I did a lot of good things for the corporation, both design-wise and in starting policy and overseas and a lot of different projects that we're involved in and different things that are there now as a result of my being with General Motors. And I'd like to leave it that way. So I don't want to go back as an old retiree, because I found this: when you're working in a workaday world, a fellow walks in, used to be a retiree. He walks in, used to work there with the guys that come. Hi, Fred. How are you? Good to see you. Geez, you're looking good. And while they're talking to you, they're shaking hands with you. They're talking to somebody else over here who's got to see them on a particular rush assignment, which is understandable. Exactly. And I walk in and I think, what the hell am I doing here? I don't need this. They're trying to be nice to me. And I thought, that's never going to happen. I've done it to other guys. Old guys, when they come back, while I was there.
Yeah.
And I said at the time, God damn it, I shouldn't have been that way to old George. God damn, it's never going to happen to me. Old Paul's not ever going to go back there that way.
And no testimonials, no benefits for you.
No, none of that. And so I won't. I don't. So I had it good, and it was good, and let's leave it at that and go on from here.
You're on another career.
Absolutely. And doing what I like to do. I enjoy it. There's nothing like sleeping in the morning, getting up when you feel like it, going out in the day. You get up and you say, God, there's, I love what I'm doing. You get up and you say, isn't it beautiful? God, there's, I don't know, can't be another day as nice as this. The blue sky, and the leaves are out, and the grass is green, the air is just right, and it's fantastic. I don't have a boat anymore, but I used to have a boat, and I was a boater for many years. I had a 35-foot Chris Craft, and I'd drive along in a nice day. I had other smaller ones before that. I open up the windshield, and sometime in September, it's getting crisp and cool, or maybe even late August. You have the windshield, and the air is rushing. It's cool. It's almost on the verge of being chilly, but it's fantastic. And I look around and say, Paul, you're the luckiest guy in the world. Where could you be where you enjoy it more? The water's splashing, it's blue, the sky is blue. It's just the best time of the world. People are on board having a good time. I just really enjoy it. I've enjoyed life, and I'm going to continue to as long as I can. Yeah, I think it is.
Thank you, Paul W. Gillen, General Motors designer for many years, and now his own man and his own artist.
Thank you, Dave.
Mr. Gillen has agreed to add an interesting postscript to design history, the genesis of the well-known early post-war Oldsmobile grill, and who actually designed and fabricated it.
Sure, I'd be glad to, Dave. Actually, you just have to have a picture here of the Olds 98, the 1948 Oldsmobile. And I just mentioned to you that grill was, many people have taken credit for it, but I happen to know that was designed by a modeler named Charlie Stobar.
Spell that.
S-T-O-B-A-R.
Mm-hmm. What was Stobar's background?
And Stobar's background was that of a sculptor, and clay modeler, and he eventually left General Motors to become a director of all fabrication.
Had he originally had a firm with his brother, I believe?
Yes, both Charlie and Leonard Stobar.
Known as the Stobar
Brothers. Known as the Stobar Brothers, mm-hmm. and they both were working as clay modelers.
Mm-hmm.
And then Leonard Stobar came into Oldsmobile Studio right after that, and Charlie Stobar went into another studio.
Tell me how Charlie got this particular assignment, do you remember?
Well, right after the war, Harley Earl was starting the nucleus of a design staff, because a lot of the people were still engaged in war work, a lot of the employees.
Mm-hmm.
And so he asked Charlie to do some work on a front end.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie took the liberty of making the front end the way he thought it should look.
Mm-hmm.
And without direction from anyone, came up with the design, and it was liked so well that,
mm-hmm.
that no designer ever put his finger into it after that. So the design was accepted.
Can you describe it in audio terms, translate visual terms to audio terms?
Well, up to that time, all grills, the hole for the air to cool the car in the front end, usually consisted of a header bar with a filling of either bars or some type of grill work. This car was unique in that it was aircraft inspired and consisted of a huge header bar which went across the front of the car, turning down at the ends. It was very, very close to the close above the height of the bumper. Beneath it was a secondary bar attached to the bumper, along with bumper guards that worked fore and aft directly under this huge header bar, and was actually the appearance of being a bumper grill, and was one of the forerunners of today's bumper grill.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a huge air intake and not
mm-hmm.
filled with grill work of any type.
You caught on, and how long did it last in one form or another?
Well, it became Dave, you were mentioning the Club de Mer, which was one of our Motorama show cars. I have the design patent for the front end of that automobile. That also did not have a complete grill, but actually was like an aircraft type opening in the front. And it was a very sleek automobile, all constructed of aluminum. After the aluminum was all assembled, it was all brush finished, and a cerulean blue glaze was put over the whole car, so that the brushed aluminum effect shone through, but in effect it was a highly metallic blue finish. A very beautiful automobile. The seats were bright red leather, and the finned wheel discs were the first of its type, which I also have the design patent on, and which set the trend for wheel discs for quite some time to come.
It was a cooling device.
It was a cooling device, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stars, I put the stars on the side of that automobile, and then the stars went on many Pontiacs after that. And they called it the Star Chief model, and it was designated by the amount of stars on
That's
the side
right.
of it.
Yeah.
That
and
sort
the
of
scallops
thing.
Were later down.
And the scallops,
down.
Too, yes.
Yeah.
They were.
Are
so
these called wind splits?
Yeah, those are wind splits.
Yeah.
You're right. Then they put the fin on the back, which was not necessary, but they put on there just for an effect. Being a Club de Mer, Car of the Sea, if they put that on, it has a shark-like effect and also directional stability.
What year was this?
Aid. That car was, that was probably 1954.
1954?
Yeah, it was 1954.
Now, was there an occasion for this to be done? Or
yes, the Motorama.
This is for the 54 Motorama?
Yes.
Ah, okay.
So it went around the country in all the Motoramas.
Was that a sensation of the show?
Oh, yes, it was a sensation of the show. Everyone loved this automobile.
Yeah.
It was a great, great little car. It got a tremendous amount of popularity.
Was it a drivable
Oh, yes, it was
vehicle?
drivable automobile.
Motor?
Had a motor in the car.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you take it outside? Did you recall ever
Oh, yeah,
around outside?
Yeah, driving around the outside in the car. It was a thrill just to drive it. Like that,
Club
yeah.
De Mer.
The Club de Mer. And Club of the Sea. You see, Harley Earl he named the automobile, and he called it Club de Mer because he wanted the automobile to be announced at the Miami show that year.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a friend who owned the surf club in North Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very, very exclusive club. People from all over the world belonged to it. The man that owned the club, although these people were members, he was the director and owned the whole damn thing. It was his property and so on. And he loved to put on shows. So he had a fascination with staging musicals and so on. So periodically, like every 6-8 weeks, he would put on a show. If people were down there, they'd come to see it. And if it was something spectacular, they'd come from all over the world, fly in to see this guy's show. And he was a rather effeminate guy. He used to, I had to go down there on occasion with Jack Didion, and he had glasses. His eyeglasses were very pale metallic blue, which up to that time I'd only seen women wearing glasses like that, and with little sparkles in them. And he was a rather effeminate guy, but he was a guy who was very headstrong and wanted his own way on everything, and could get it because he owned the club. Since Earl wanted the car announced down there, he asked me to have to obtain a chassis of a small Corvette, which was a child's toy at the time and run on electric batteries, a small car that children could ride in. Mm-hmm. Earl asked me to obtain one of those, which I did. We had it, bought it and shipped it in, and then he asked that this Club de Mer design be scaled down and a miniature replica of the Club de Mer be made to be shown down at this surf club in Florida. And he made the car for his grandson, Tiger. And Tiger was to get the car and drive it off. So, because I remember when it was quite a while before our staff could get around to developing a body for it, because I remember having the Corvette model put in my trunk, stuck out the back. We had long trunks in those days. I drove it home, let my little girls drive it all around. I remember walking half a mile away because the storage battery ran out of juice and I had to push the thing back. At any rate, I took the thing back to General Motors. They put the Club de Mer on it, and Tiger Earl, his grandson, drove the car down there on the stage that night.
He did.
But Earl also wanted the Club de Mer, the full-size model announced down there. So he had to arrange to have a crane brought in to lift over the wall because there was no opening in the wall to drive the car through. So he had a crane lift the car over the wall, and all people from all over the world came to that show. Well, sometimes this guy came up with very corny notions for backgrounds and music and the rest of it. So Earl said, called me in one day along with Jack Didion and said, "Fellas, I want you guys, it's a tough assignment, but I want you guys to go down and see that this guy doesn't put on a corny show in his own place, because we're announcing this thing. So make sure the background has something to do with cars, or make it look like Detroit in the background, or do something there." So we were going to do that, and at that particular time, Pontiac had, Mr. Critchfield, who was the president of Pontiac at the time, had to fly down to Florida for some reason. So he and his wife were flying down. He had the plane. So Earl asked Didion and I to take our wives with us to Florida. Mm-hmm. And Bob Emmerich, who was the head publicity man for a PR guy out there, well, Bob, took his wife along. Another guy who since has bought the Buffalo Bills football team, he and his wife, no, his wife didn't go, that's right.
Wilson.
Wilson went along at the time. And because I remember his wife brought him over to the airport that year, a real good-looking blonde, I remember. Mm. I'm sorry she wasn't going. At any rate, we all got on the plane and flew down, and you fly down a GM plane, and they always had food and liquor on it. But in those days, we went on a DC-3, and that meant landing in Louisville and Columbus, or in somewhere in Georgia, probably Atlanta, and then we flew down the coast. And it was very, very nice because Critchfield wanted us to see how all the big hotels looked along the coast. We flew very, very low, right along the ocean front, in front of all the buildings. But at that time, we were flying actually down, Didion and I, to go down to work with this guy on there. But one interesting thing, I think, you find on the flight, on the way going down, Bob Emmerich got on the radio, the pilot's compartment, and said that he made a list of what all the women were wearing, you know, wanted to be wearing a pink outfit, wanted to be wearing a blue and a green, and see, he told the dealership in Miami to have a car for each of us at the airport for our use, mm-hmm. and make the cars the same color, have the cars done in the same color as what our wives were wearing. Mm-hmm. So then Bob then came in and announced then, now when you fellas get off the airport down here when we land, just look for the car with the same color as your wife's dress. That's your car.
Right.
Yeah, so we did that. We stayed out at the, Key Biscayne Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very nice out there, you know. We stayed in the hotel, and Critchfield had a villa out there, and then every night they have a cocktail party in his villa. It was a real nice deal. But anyway, Diddy and I went over and tried to persuade this guy in a nice way, because, you know, it belongs to the man, and he's set on what he's doing. But anyway, we prevailed and came up with a background there of Detroit. And with all the lights in the Penobscot building, it wasn't what it was now with Rensa and so, but we had all this background there, and we came up with what we thought was a pretty good show. Mm-hmm. It was put together with the talent that he had to work with. And Roe was very, very pleased with the announcement of the car down there. It was pretty good.
Well, let's record for posterity that the Club de Mer was your design.
Yeah, it was my design. Yeah, I have design patents on that.
That's smart.
The front end and the rest of the thing on there. But that's also the automobile that Harley Earl wanted to, because the car was only 38 and a half inches to the top of the windshield, he wanted to make sure that the passengers weren't higher than the automobile for publicity pictures.
Yeah.
So he had the shop cut a huge hole under the seats and put a rubber bladder underneath there, so with the depression of the seats, the person's posterior would be resting only about an inch or so above the ground.
This is probably your proudest achievement, do you think?
Well, it's
in terms
probably
of show cars,
yeah.
Idea, try,
yeah, I did some other show cars, which I thought were very, very good there too.
Oh, can you tell us about some of them?
Oh yeah, I can tell you about some of those other cars.
Sure,
some nice looking automobiles there. GM cars are turning around. Yeah. In asking about today's GM car designs, I feel that today's automobiles are beginning to turn around for the better, and are going. It's just the beginning now of a new era in automotive design.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a long time now, our designs have been, as people call, the econobox design. They all look like they were done with a cookie cutter. I'm talking about not only General Motors cars, but all automobiles, including the design competition from overseas. And I think General Motors made somewhat of a breakthrough, and it wasn't probably unanimously received. I'm talking about the breakthrough that we made on the Cadillac Seville, in that we didn't have a regular trunk. We had a trunk that went out a la the old classic Rolls-Royce line. But the car looked different, and the car sloped in the back, and it had direction, and it had elegance. And more than anything, I feel we've lost elegance in our automobiles today. Elegance has to come about as a result of a lot of things, mainly a sophistication which is achieved through smooth lines, lines that carry through, lines that delight the eye, an exhibit of a form which excites you when you see it. A box is not visually exciting. You've seen boxes, there's four sides, a top and a bottom, and that's it. And that's pretty much a combination of what our automobiles are and have been in the last few years, a combination of boxes. And understandably, they've done that because the cars have gotten smaller, and a box is probably more commodious than shapes which would stretch out the lines and
limit
interior room. And so a box from that point of view would probably be economically the best way to go. But it certainly isn't an exciting form. And an automobile has come over the years, grown to be a part of us. It's something that we want to be excited about. It's something that we want to be proud of when it's parked in our driveway, or when we go to church on Sunday, we want to be proud of what we're driving. It's an integral part of us. And I think that there's a way to make automobiles small and still make them exciting.
Do you think GM is pointing in that direction?
I think GM isn't pointing that way, but not just General Motors, also Ford Motor Company.
Mm-hmm.
I think Ford's new line of cars, they're Fords, and their Lincolns are very, very well designed automobiles. I think they're visually exciting automobiles. I think they look good.
You spent a number of years, almost two decades in Europe. You're very well acquainted with the aero look, the aero concept, the aerodynamic concept,
I am, yes, I am. But oddly enough, it wasn't practiced in Europe.
wasn't it?
Their dynamic concept wasn't practiced in Europe as much as it was in this country. They've always had rather boxy designs over there. You can look way back at the old Rolls Royces. You can look back at the old Mercedes. They were all very boxy automobiles.
Yeah,
and if anything now, we've emulated their style by going boxy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think we've always had pretty exciting, well-styled automobiles.
So very recently, the aerodynamic look was inherent in much of American design.
I think it was. Inherent, aerodynamic perhaps in appearance,
yeah.
Not necessarily in function. They found out since with their wind tunnels that oftentimes it belies us to say that function is can best be described by flat boxes. So
do you feel that form follows function? Is that a personal design philosophy?
Well, I think it's a good design philosophy, and I think it's right. But I think form follows function. But then I think that you have to decorate that function to make it acceptable sometime and exciting.
Yeah.
Because you can take a cough drop or a lozenge, and it's very functional, and it's you swallow it and it slips down smoothly. But if you wouldn't want to design everything that way, the old bar soap design.
What about the Euro look? What mm-hmm. is the Euro? Is that a phony slogan?
I think it's a phony slogan. I think because people on this side of the water think if it comes from Europe, it's got to be nice. And it's overused. It's completely overused on everything. Mm-hmm. Even the automotive writers love to say that. It's got the European flavor.
Yeah.
It's European-inspired design.
Yeah.
What is European-inspired design? Just what you've asked. What is it? Well, you have to go back and say, what were they doing in Europe a few years ago? What are they doing now? They haven't come up anything that's innovative, new, and exciting. I sincerely feel this. The Mercedes is a wonderful automobile. The wheel, steering wheel's too big. It's like driving a truck when you drive a Mercedes. They're squared off. I think they get their romance through their craftsmanship, their finish, the ability to put out a good automobile. But I don't think that the design is particularly innovative. They still have a large, tall, flat grill on the automobile, reminiscent of the first cars. And Rolls-Royce, pretty much the same way. And
I suppose it's their sense of roundness in miniature, perhaps.
Yes, and I would say that when people talk about the Euro look, they're talking about the very limited production cars such as the Ferrari, the Maserati, and those that are built by custom Italian coach builders. They come out with nice cars, but
graceful, rounded,
aerodynamic, very pleasing, slippery forms,
right.
Yeah, and yet oftentimes with just enough interest on to make them exciting.
Those aren't the bread and butter cars.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Boxy.
Yeah, and so the automobile writers like to refer to those as or anything we do as competitive with that type of thing. And we're not really in competition with that type of car at all. Perhaps our Corvette is, even some of the Mustangs, but other than that, I would say that...
What about the new Thunderbird?
I like the Thunderbird. Yeah, I have a friend with a Thunderbird. I've driven it. I like it very much. It's a nice automobile.
The Taurus that is coming out this year.
Taurus is nice. The Mercur, which comes from Germany. It's a nice car.
That seems to have pretty much European antecedents in the sense that they're utilizing what Porsche is doing and what Audi is doing.
That's true, and yet if you look at the T-Bird, it's very, very much like a T-Bird.
Yeah, it's true. I remember the Taurus Sable seems to be pretty much an Audi conception.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. I like an Audi.
Yeah. But the Thunderbird is really slightly unique.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Thunderbird's a very nice car. Now, the Audi has got a real slippery design. It's a nice car, and I think if any car there in Europe right now would point the way to maybe the way future, the way we'd be going on things, it would be probably the Audi. But then again, I think this year's Buick Electra and Olds 98 fit in that same vein. I have a new Buick Park Avenue, and it's a very slippery car, smooth front on it and everything. It's not the most interesting car I've ever seen, but it's sure a good driver.
You mentioned Bob Lutz not too long ago. Did you know, was he the same, or did you know Bob Lutz when he was with Opel?
Yeah, I knew Bob Lutz when he was with Opel.
Yeah,
yeah, I had lunch with him over there when he was having some old car restored over there at the time.
Yeah.
He's an old car nut and a motorcycle enthusiast.
Apparently, he was hired away by Ford, and he developed the Sierra, did he not, or at least under his direction.
That's what I hear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you've had a fascinating career. We're very pleased that you came and spent the time.
Well, thank you. So I'm really sorry I took up so much of your time.
No, our pleasure.
Yeah. You're going to be hungry for a long time because skipping lunch is probably not one of your favorite things.
It's good for my diet. Thank you, Paul W. Gillen.
Mm-hmm.